from the beginning, English has sopped up words from every tongue it's encountered. Our language has the capacity to embrace new influences that can be traced across continents and centuries. But for a long time, William Shakespeare has gotten a lot of credit for words we use today, like generous, gloomy, frugal, no, no, and no. And the list goes on from there. From Shakespeare's play Titus Andronicus, gloomy is one of the many words commonly misattributed to Shakespeare.
Lavinia, wert thou thus surprised, sweet girl, ravished and wronged as Philomela was, forced in the ruthless, vast, and gloomy woods? See, see.
We're talking about why the Bard gets so much credit and where these words come from in the first place. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Jonathan Hope. He's an English professor at University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. He's author of several books on this, including Shakespeare's Grammar, the authorship of Shakespeare's plays, and Shakespeare and Language, Reason, Eloquence, and Artifice in the Renaissance. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you very much.
Well, somewhere between 1,300 words and 1,700 words that are frequently the numbers thrown out attributed to Shakespeare. But you have been on a journey as well to say, hey, no, this is not right. Shakespeare didn't invent this many words, and perhaps he might not have invented any at all. What do you know?
Yeah, for the past kind of 3 or 4 years, I've been using some of the most recent databases and developments in literary study and digital studies to look at the evidence for where these words first come into English. And in the past, that evidence has come from the Oxford English Dictionary. People have found Shakespeare's name at the top of the list for lots of those words. But once you start to look into it a bit more carefully and use the new databases that are available, those words suddenly start disappearing. And so far in the work that I've done, I haven't found a single one that stands up.
Well, so is the OED here at fault? How did this myth come about?
Yeah, that's a good question. It actually isn't the fault of the OED. The Oxford English Dictionary is a fantastic monument of Victorian scholarship, an absolutely amazing achievement, and still quite rightly viewed as the authority on words of English. But what happened was the people of, and especially I have to say, unfortunately from my discipline, literary scholars have misread the evidence in the OED. The OED, for every word, if people have ever looked at it, it's an amazing book to read. Every word has a definition, as you'd expect in a dictionary, but what the OED has that most dictionaries don't is then a list of historical examples of each word being used as its meaning changes over the centuries. And those examples are drawn from, in many cases, famous writers, in some cases, not so famous writers. And literary scholars have got themselves into the mindset that the earliest citation, what the OED calls the first citation, for each word is in fact the first usage of that word in English. And in fact, that's not the case. And the editors and the compilers of the OED never claimed that.
Is Shakespeare, though, the convenient historical citation on a number of words?
He can be. Do you mean is he kind of the best?
Kind of, yeah, the best, the best example out there. When you look at a particular word like gloomy, the OED says, aha, look at this context. Brilliant. Let's get it in the dictionary in more of a convenient sense.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. What the OED told the people searching for these examples were generally amateur scholars all around the English-speaking world, hundreds, I mean, really very large numbers of them. And their guidelines were to look for examples that were good examples, so that really illustrated in a short space of words, would give someone a clear idea of what the word meant at the time. And we would therefore be able to use those examples to get a sense of how the words the meaning had changed. So yes, they were looking for good examples, not necessarily the earliest or the first example of the usage of a word.
So really crowdsourcing scholars to say, hey, we need to do perhaps a little more digging here to be able to get to really the heart of where these words came from?
Yeah, and crowdsourcing is a really good way of thinking about what they were doing in the 19th century, because they were trying to read basically every book that still existed that had been published in English and get examples of all of the words from them. And people sent in their examples on little slips of paper, and they all arrived in Oxford, and there was an actual shed at the bottom of someone's garden with lots of pigeonholes in it, and they collected all of the examples, and then the editors went through them to decide which were the best examples to use. But the books that they were reading were scattered all over the world in different rare books libraries. Some of these books, there's only one copy of the book in existence now. So it really needed an army of people to do that work. But one of the great things about the period we're living in now is that those books have been digitized, and it's possible to search them all using various free open access websites. Anyone can do this now. You can search about 60,000 books from the period in seconds. So you can reproduce the searches that it took years and hundreds of people to do just from your laptop and your kitchen table.
So did I hear you say right that the sifting of word origins, you know, the business of that really went down in an English garden? Because that's a really lovely setting for, you know, a work of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there was a huge amount. It wasn't someone just lying around in a garden, you know, sipping a pims while they decided which words to go in. It was, you know, there were hundreds and hundreds of slips. And the early editor of the OED, they kind of got pushed out of his house by all of the slips. So they ended up specifically building a shed in his garden. I don't know how nice it was. It probably wasn't that nice a shed, but that's pretty much where it was all happening, yeah.
Jonathan Hope is our guide this hour. He's an English professor and Shakespeare scholar at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. You can join in with your questions, your observations about Shakespeare's use of words at 800-642-1234. Do you have any Shakespearean myths that you want to bust, or any facts you've heard about Shakespeare that you're just not sure how true they are? Do you have a favorite word or phrase from Shakespeare's works? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jonathan, did Shakespeare invent any words that are obsolete today but stuck around for just a while after they appeared in his writing and then perhaps went away or went out of use, out of fashion?
Yeah, I mean, One of the things I think it's important to say is that pretty much everyone at the time that Shakespeare was writing, pretty much every writer was using new words. It was a period of huge vocabulary expansion for English. So, and one of the things I think people like me get a bit kind of angry about, or not angry, but a bit irritated by, is the notion that Shakespeare is somehow unique and special in this. I think that tends to cover over what was a period of collective invention. You know, writers of English were actively looking for new words and trying to bring them into the language. And of course, if you're bringing in lots of new words, a fair number of them are not going to catch on and are going to die a death. And actually, an awful lot do. And one kind of interesting example of that is the word laughable. Which is a pretty familiar word to us now, meaning ridiculous. You know, that dress is laughable. Mm-hmm. That argument is laughable. And Shakespeare, in fact, does seem to be one of the earliest users of that word in English. It's one of the first, when you search the databases, the new databases we have, he turns up as just about one of the first users of the word. But when you look at Shakespeare's use of it, it's not in our sense. When Shakespeare uses the word laughable, he uses it in a literal sense. He means something that is funny, something that you can laugh at. So I think it's in Winter's Tale, someone talks about a joke being laughable. Now, to us, that would be a joke that was ridiculous and actually not funny. But when the way that Shakespeare uses the word, it implies, oh, this is a hilarious joke. It's laughable.
So completely pure and not...
And so that's, right. Yeah, in that sense, just doesn't catch on. There's about two more uses of it in the 17th century and then nothing. And then the word, in effect, gets reinvented later in the 18th century with the modern sense that we have. So that's a word that some people have claimed that word as a Shakespeare invention. It might actually be one of the words that he did first use, but it doesn't catch on. It disappears.
Does fashionable have a similar story, the word fashionable?
Yeah, the word fashionable is another interesting one. So fashion, and again, it's a good illustration of the way that it's very hard to pin down the start of a word, because when meanings change and new meanings come in, it's often really difficult to see exactly where they come in. But the word fashionable is very similar to laughable. It originally means, has a literal sense of something that you can manipulate or something that you can fashion with your hand. It's often used of clay.
Ah.
We'll talk about clay being fashionable. You can make something of it. And the sense that we have now of, you know, someone who's very, very conscious about what clothes they're wearing, are they up-to-date clothes, that comes in Shakespeare's time. And Shakespeare, again, is a fairly early user of it, although not the first. But I think, to me, what that shows is the way that the linguistic community as a whole is producing these words. I think it's kind of naive and just not realistic to say that individuals make up new words, because language is a collective effort. It's not really something that one person can affect very effectively. Everyone has to go along with innovations in language, or a large number of people, for them to catch on. And we can see that, you know, words change their meanings in fairly predictable ways. Language operates as a system. It's not the plaything of any one person. But so fashionable is a kind of good example. We can see people using fashionable, moving away from the literal sense into a more kind of metaphorical sense like the one we have now. And Shakespeare's definitely, you know, in at the start of it, but he's in at the start with a group of other people. I wouldn't want to say he was driving or producing that change, but he's definitely part of it.
Well, which brings us to this idea that did writers and poets in Shakespeare's time look to each other for inspiration when they were creating? Were they creating in more of a social atmosphere where there could be perhaps some fluidity about who's saying what in their works and where these ideas come from in terms of what words they end up choosing?
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think also you have to remember these are, especially the playwrights in Shakespeare's London, These are people working in a very close-knit community, what to us is a relatively small, you know, small population city. Professional people working together, as we know for a fact that most of them kind of drank together and hung around together. And it's interesting to see quite often when you start researching these new words that they pop up in several people's work at about the same time. And especially with playwrights. So a word like zany, which comes from Italian, comes from the Italian commedia dell'arte, that crops up suddenly within the space of about 2 or 3 years in about 4 different playwrights' work.
Mm.
So you really get the sense of a linguistic community and, you know, and probably people actively saying, hey, look at this new word, isn't that, that's an interesting one. Which, you know, if anyone's been in a close-knit community at school or in the army or in the armed forces, one of the first things that happens when you put people together in a close-knit group like that is that they develop, you know, new words for things between themselves as a kind of marker of group identity.
Yeah, that jargon.
Kind of, Yeah, that linguistic, collective linguistic creativity is a real feature of human societies, I think.
Was Shakespeare inventive with his word choice? Yes, scholars say, but he didn't actually invent thousands of words. Shakespeare scholars would like to clear the air. We're helping to dispel some of the myths here on the morning show. People like to celebrate his birthday on this day, and so we thought of how fitting to do a show on the Bard. Jonathan Hope is our guide. He's an English professor and Shakespeare scholar at University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. You can join in with your questions, your observations about Shakespeare's use of words at 800-642-1233. Perhaps you have some Shakespearean myths that you want to bust, or any facts you've heard about Shakespeare that you're not sure are true. Do you have a favorite word or phrase from Shakespeare's works? Share it at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. The number of words Shakespeare is credited with inventing has been largely based on evidence found in the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, as it's called. It's the only dictionary that really tries to catalog the chronological history of most of our language, and sometimes it gets taken out of context. We're on a Shakespeare myth-busting mission on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Strathclyde University English professor Jonathan Hope is with us. He's the author of several books on Shakespeare and grammar-related issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about Shakespeare, his language, and the time he lived in? What's your favorite word or lines from his plays? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Jonathan, is it possible to really nail down the origins of words from Shakespeare's era, or do we really have to just let it go and not be so specific about where we say the origin of a word is? Because there can be a whole lot of influences from a number of different continents.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And it's interesting how fixated we are on fixing up a word to a particular point and saying it must you know, appear almost out of nothing at a precise point. And, you know, the hard truth is, given the evidence that's available, there's actually no chance of us fixing, or almost no chance of us fixing the birth of any word, because we can search a very large proportion of all of the books that were published at the time that are still extant, but many books that were published at the time no longer exist. The estimates vary between about a third to two-thirds of the total number of books printed at the time do not exist anymore. So that's a huge amount of evidence that's gone. There's a huge amount of writing in manuscript that hasn't been transcribed. We're searching through it at the moment and starting to transcribe it. So our evidence is getting better there, but a huge amount of manuscript materials disappeared as well. So that's evidence that's gone forever. There's no way of getting that back. And of course, most language doesn't happen on the page. Most language happens in speech, as I'm speaking now. And of course, you know, it sounds like an obvious point, but it's an important one. There's no way of there was no way of tape recording early modern speech. So the whole, you know, amount of spoken language from the time has disappeared forever. And probably most words are first used in speech. So, you know, the idea that we could somehow capture the moment that a word is born into a language for the vast majority of words is just impossible. So we can only ever get a kind of general sense of, okay, this is the earliest example we can find. So we assume that the word probably came in around that time. But already there's a very interesting, very large-scale manuscript transcription project going on at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. at the moment. And they've just started transcribing huge amounts of manuscript material that they have from the time in their holdings. And already they're producing antedatings to the OED of up to 200 years on words and phrases. And that just gives us a sense of how much new material there is buried in the material that we have available to us, but also a very kind of warning shot across our bows saying, and think about all the material that's lost.
Right. Let's bring in Danny now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Danny.
Hey, happy birthday, Shakespeare. my question for the guest has to do with something that the poet John Keats described as negative capability, about Shakespeare's ability to take his own opinions out of the characters in the play, to not project what he thought about an idea, whether it was politics or love or any of the other ideas explored in Shakespeare's play. I know there's some examples, like in Henry IV and Henry V, where the characters talk about honor and they describe it in different ways. Falstaff says honor is nothing, it's air. Hal says honor is everything. If it be a sin to covet honor, I'm the most offending soul alive. I'm wondering if your guest has other specific examples where Shakespeare removed his own opinion from the play, and you could see the same idea getting debated and explored in different ways. Thank you.
Great question, Danny. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, it is a great question, and it's for me, I actually say to Danny, you know, he's actually put his finger on what for me is the kind of central strength of Shakespeare. And I think one of the things that if you're searching for an explanation for why Shakespeare is so good, and I do think he's, you know, the best writer in English by a long way, I think, you know, this ability to present different sides of an argument without any kind of sense of, okay, well, Shakespeare's showing us this side, but he doesn't really agree with it. He really agrees with this other one. This ability to present different sides is just his absolute kind of, I think it's a thing that allows so many different people to get different things out of the plays. And it's one of the big explanations for why Shakespeare's been so consistently popular and has been at the center of English literature ever, pretty much since the 18th century. I mean, there was a kind of dip just after he died, but pretty much since the 18th century, he's been absolutely at the center of English literature. And Danny asked me for specific examples, but actually what I want to say about this is I think there is almost nowhere in Shakespeare where you can't find this. It's just absolutely all the way through all of the plays. And interestingly, it can be traced back to an Elizabethan grammar school exercise, which is called Argument in Utrem Partem Quae, where Elizabethan grammar school boys were taught to argue a case or a historical situation or a mythical situation, to take up the position of one of the participants in that and argue their case. And then the next day they were told, and now take up the position of someone on the opposite side and argue their case. So one of the kind of rhetorical trainings that schoolboys got and people at university got was exactly this ability to remove your own opinions from a kind of imaginative recreation of something and put yourself entirely in the position of someone in a particular situation and just argue from their point of view, and then crucially to switch and to do it from the opposite side. And of course, I think it doesn't take much thinking to realize that that's a very, very useful technique for a dramatist who has to be able to put lots of different positions on stage at the same time.
Something that college debaters try to hone their craft with in their pursuits as well.
Yeah, and it comes from the same classical rhetorical training. The historical roots of that are exactly the same.
Why has Shakespeare stood the test of time when other playwrights fell by the wayside?
Yeah, well, so I mean, there are kind of two main responses to that. One is what one of the things I've just said, which is I think that, you know, Shakespeare is, as a writer, is almost uniquely able to hold himself back. I mean, everyone thinks they have an inside line to Shakespeare. Say, oh, Shakespeare was an X or Shakespeare was a Y. But you can see equally convincing arguments. Oh, Shakespeare was a conservative. Oh no, Shakespeare was a liberal. Shakespeare was left wing. No, Shakespeare was right wing. Different people can go to those plays and get perfectly good evidence for the notion that Shakespeare was anything. And I think that's because he was able to really hold his own opinions back and be entirely in the moment with the characters and entirely in the characters. And that's made the plays multiply available to multiple people in multiple ways over time. And that's something that I don't think any other writer is quite as good at as Shakespeare is. That's the kind of argument for Shakespeare's genius in this. There is another argument which I think is important to acknowledge, which is that, and some literary theorists have argued this, which is that once Shakespeare gets to a certain level of cultural capital, in other words, once he becomes so important within English-speaking culture, it's actually very hard not to like Shakespeare, or at least not to pretend that you like Shakespeare, and that it kind of becomes like a nuclear reaction, but it just produces its own energy. So that the kind of extremes of this argument are people who would say actually Shakespeare is not that good. It's just that we all have to pretend that he is. I mean, I don't go along with that.
But, yeah, Shakespeare. Shakespeare went viral or something in modern language.
And it produces its own, you know, the idea that it becomes like a fusion reaction. It's producing its own energy, and it's actually nothing to do with Shakespeare. It's all to do with how he's treated culturally. I don't buy that entirely, but I think there's definitely a certain amount of truth in it. I'm sure that quite a lot of people have been, you know, forced to go to Shakespeare plays and pretended to enjoy them and haven't really. Considering they're 400 years old, the language is quite difficult.
English professor Jonathan Hope is our guide this hour. He's written several books on Shakespeare, the wordsmith. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you recall being taught that Shakespeare invented a lot of words that we still use today? Do you have any Shakespearean myths you want to bust, or perhaps words that you use that you thought were attributed to Shakespeare? You can call in at 800-642-1234. For email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jonathan, Shakespeare died more than 400 years ago, but original scripts from his era live on with this new digital archive. What can we do today through this digital archive in a way we couldn't in the past to manipulate language and to crunch numbers on the language he used?
Well, now that we can do these searches, you know, really fast, we can search all kinds of linguistic features in plays. One of the things that I think is going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years is we're going to get a much better idea of how Shakespeare fits into his context. So how he is typical of early modern culture. So the things that he does that everyone else is doing, but also how he's unique and how he's different and the things that he does that actually nobody else does. And up to now, we have a kind of skewed version of Shakespeare, because he is so important in Anglophone culture that it's, and the made up words myth is a really good example of this. When we find something in Shakespeare, we tend to assume, without any evidence, that it is somehow unique to Shakespeare and that nobody else does it. So everything we see in Shakespeare that we think is good, we say, oh, that's purely Shakespeare's unique genius. So we see a word in Shakespeare, we don't find it anywhere else, we say, oh, Shakespeare made this word up. But as soon as we start looking a bit more carefully, oh no, that word was being used 30, 40, 50 years before he was born. So I think that as we explore the databases which give us effectively the whole of early modern print culture, we can start really to see actually most of these things that we've said were unique to Shakespeare are in fact things that almost any writer at the time were doing. Maybe not as well as Shakespeare, maybe not as interestingly as Shakespeare, but they're all doing it. Lots of people are inventing new words. Lots of people are interested in words at the time. But of course, there must be things that Shakespeare is doing that other people aren't, because he's, I would say, clearly better than them. So again, one of the interesting things and one of the really exciting things for me as a scholar of Shakespeare is that I think the digital study of Shakespeare and crunching big numbers and is the ability that it gives you to compare him with all of the other writers at the time. And that's something that nobody has been able to do up to now, because you know there have always been great scholars of early modern literature who have read hugely within the literature, but you know, with the best will in the world, you can't really read more than about 200, 300 books and know them very well. But in fact, we have 60,000 in the databases. So the ability to make comparisons between Shakespeare and all of those 60,000 texts is something that's entirely new. And that's something that's going to enable us to understand Shakespeare much better, because we'll finally be sure of the things that he was doing that nobody else was, and also be sure of the things that he was doing that come out of his culture. I mean, Shakespeare is very often in universities, he's taught separately from other writers at the period, and it's one of the few writers who's treated like this. So he's kind of taken out of time. We almost treat him as if he didn't live at a particular time. We kind of take him out of time. We just have classes called Shakespeare. We don't use them generally. It's kind of changing. There's some universities who do teach Shakespeare with other writers, but it's still very common for university English departments to have classes which are just Shakespeare. And of course, I think people should study Shakespeare. I think he's amazing. I think he's great. But if you study him in isolation, then you run the risk of not really understanding how he fits into his culture and not really understanding what's unique to him and what is simply, or what is interestingly, his own early modern English culture coming out. And that's one thing that really interests me about digital work and studying the period generally.
So when you analyze and crunch that huge database of 60,000 texts to compare Shakespeare to other writers of the time, what kind of letter grade does he get?
Well, this is one of the interesting and also embarrassing things for those of us who are currently working in digital quantitative literary studies is one of the terms for it, or distant reading is another one people might have heard, or big data. So far we've been crunching a lot of numbers and we've been drawing some amazing graphs and visualizations. But one of the interesting things is that pretty much on every metric that we've used so far, Shakespeare comes out right bang in the middle on the average. He doesn't stand out. He doesn't look strange. He doesn't look fun. He doesn't look weird. He doesn't look amazing. He's right in the middle of the graphs. When we started doing this work, I thought that Shakespeare would appear right on the edge, miles away from everyone else, because of course he's better than everyone else, so he's going to look different to everyone else. But so far, nobody has found whatever it is that makes Shakespeare so different to everyone else.
Once upon a time, there were thousands of words attributed to Shakespeare as the inventor of words, but that list now is down to perhaps less than 1,000. We're understanding why there's been this tendency to give Shakespeare so much credit for the words, for the plays. Here we're talking about it on the morning show. English professor Jonathan Hope is our guide. He's written several books on Shakespeare, the wordsmith. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember being taught that Shakespeare invented a lot of words that we still use today? Do you have any Shakespearean myths that you want to address? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Here is the upshot. Shakespeare did not invent thousands of words, and English professor Jonathan Hope is helping us understand why Shakespeare gets so much credit. He's also encouraging other scholars to set their students to work on this task of sleuthing beyond Shakespeare for the origin of words. He thinks a very high percentage of English words, if not all, predate Shakespeare. We're delving into this on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, getting your thoughts on Shakespeare's language, the terms you thought he coined, the ones you wish he coined. Bring on your perspectives at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Rich joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. I'd appreciate it if the professor could speak to the point of plagiarism. Our current concept of plagiarism is that we can copyright just about anything and claim it as our own. Shakespeare was totally dependent on sources from all over the place, and I maintain there's still many a dissertation to be written about where did he get this or where did he get that, and he was the consummate borrower of ideas, words, and phrases.
Rich, thanks so much for the call. Jonathan Hope, what about borrowing and stealing?
Yeah, and thanks, Rich. That's another great point. And another point that gets us right to the core of Renaissance aesthetic culture, actually. Shakespeare was a borrower, and he was a borrower because he was trained to be a borrower. And anyone who had, again, we go back to Elizabethan grammar school education and rhetoric and general Renaissance rhetorical education. The whole kind of ethos of Renaissance education was the notion of finding material in other people's writing and then making it your own. And it's actually a very hard concept for us to grasp, because we live in a kind of post-romantic period, and that's romantic with a big R. Our notions of aesthetics and what writers should do are very influenced by the romantic poets and the notion of originality. And we think writers should make stuff up and kind of, you know, produce things out of their heads that haven't existed before. And that wasn't really what the Renaissance thought writers should do. The Renaissance thought writers should read a lot of other people's work and mark the bits that they liked, and they actually were encouraged to have common books, notebooks called commonplace books, where you wrote down things that you really liked, and you were writing those down because you were trying to. And Seneca, for example, many of the writers who write about this talk about it as a process of digestion, that you take the food in, and then you digest it and becomes part of your body. And that you can then write, and you can use this material in the same way as you use food to help you walk around for energy. So we almost think of it as plagiarism, but they thought of it as reabsorption and then reuse. So very often when and this kind of lies behind this desire on our part to find the origins and to find the originator of a word and to discover who was it first used this word. People in the Renaissance were not interested in the first use of something because generally they distrusted things that had just been made up.
Hmm.
So if you spontaneously just create something, we think that's what poets should do. In the Renaissance, they thought, well, actually, you know, if nobody has thought this before, if nobody said this before, it's probably not right. Because if no one's thought of it before, you know, that probably means it's not a very good thing. It's probably not true. The borderline between a fictional story Renaissance, they tended to assume that fiction was lies rather than truth. And the word we've been using, we often talk about Shakespeare inventing words, and actually invention is an interesting concept to think about in relation to this, because, again, we think of invention, to us, it's producing something entirely new. Invent something, it's entirely new. In the Renaissance, they had a Latin-derived term from rhetoric, which is inventio, and that specifically means collecting other people's stuff and making it into your own. It means assembling the materials from other people's works. And, of course, Shakespeare famously, I think, barely makes up a single story. I think there may be one or two of his plays where we don't know the source of the story. He takes stories from other people and rewrites them, and that's an absolutely typical Renaissance thing to do. And he's being absolutely on the average. He's doing exactly what every other writer did there.
He's just fueling his creativity.
Yeah, and we think of, our response to that is, oh, he's stealing stories, he's stealing other people's works. No, in the Renaissance, that was exactly, yeah, he's fueling his own creativity. He's taking stories from other people and changing them. And that's where, to the Renaissance, that's where the creativity came in.
Let's go to Mark now, joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I was interested in the influence of French upon playwrights of that day and how they freed themselves from the influence of French and became a more of an English literary society.
Thanks, Mark. Jonathan.
Yeah, that's another great question. You've got some very good listeners here.
We do.
I would say, that's not just narrow, that's not just restricted to French. We should also think about all of the vernacular languages of Europe, specifically Italian and Spanish and French, and also Latin. And in Shakespeare's time, there was a huge, very, very contested and very widespread debate about the status of English and about whether English as a language was up to the standard of the other European vernaculars, in French, Italian, Spanish. And generally the answer was no. This is English people saying, our language is hardly used beyond the shores of Dover, and it wasn't even entirely used within England at that time. I mean, English was a very, the situation was exactly the opposite to what it is now. So people were very conscious of the status of English as a language, and the status wasn't great. And there were several different kind of plans put forward to try and develop the language. And the main plan, and again, it's very opposite to what we're talking about here, was that people felt English just didn't have enough words. That the other European vernaculars had a lot more words, which enabled them to talk about more things, which made them better languages. So we're pretty practical about this notion. And the solutions that were offered to this were also pretty practical. So there were, I suspect Mark is alluding to this. So there are two kind of lines on how English should be developed at the time. And again, people were very down on English. They said, well, it's clearly not as good as French, Italian, and Spanish. But they weren't pessimistic about it. They said, okay, well, we can just make it better. They were, again, they were kind of optimistic about what could be done to the language. And there were two solutions were proposed. One was, we go back to older stages of English, because people were reading a lot of Middle English and Old English texts, and they were realizing, there are a load of words that we don't use anymore. We could just start using them again. So you get people like Edmund Spenser, for example, who writes poetry which is quite deliberately archaic in its vocabulary. So he's trying to bring words back into English that have fallen out of use. And then there are other writers who look to Latin and French and Italian and Spanish and say, well, look at all of these words in those languages. Why don't we just bring them into English, and then we'll make English better than those languages? So it very quickly becomes rather jingoistic and nationalist. But of course, if we look at the history of the English vocabulary and look at the way that the English vocabulary is structured today, you can see that those are the people, in effect, who won out, the borrowers from Latin and French and Spanish. And so, to go back to Mark's original question, which was about how does English escape the influence or the kind of influence of French, paradoxically, one of the ways you can say that English escapes that kind of feeling of inferiority to French, Italian, Latin, Spanish, is by stealing the words. And you just absorb a lot of the vocabulary from those languages, and hey presto, English is suddenly better than those languages because it's got more words, which is a kind of slightly crude quantitative way of looking at it. But I don't think it's too far from the cultural truth that that's what happens. English kind of gets its self-respect by borrowing all of these words from other languages.
So in this work of analyzing thousands upon thousands of texts of Shakespeare and other writers at the time, doing the really deep dive into comparisons and contrasts, do you see us at all reordering the works of Shakespeare in terms of the priorities we set in teaching it and how we teach it?
I think that's very likely. Because I think one of the things that's going to happen, and we're starting to see it in very small little points, one of the things that happens once you start comparing Shakespeare to the whole, you know, there's 60,000 texts, most of which, of course, nobody alive has read, suddenly you start to see connections between Shakespeare's texts and very, very obscure texts that, you know, people just don't know about. And some of those connections are going to go back to Mark's question. Some of those connections are not plagiarism, but are influence. So we're going to discover texts that have influenced Shakespeare that we don't currently know about. So we're going to get a shift in our understanding, not just of Shakespeare, but also of early modern cultures. Oh, suddenly this obscure little schoolroom poem, which at the time everybody read, but since nobody has bothered to read, oh, we can see that Shakespeare is actually getting ideas and vocabulary and stories from that. So I think, yes, I think it will change the way that we teach Shakespeare. And hopefully, one of the things I would like to think is going to happen is that we'll teach Shakespeare much more in the context of what he was reading. And we'll link to a lot of texts that are not part of the current literary canon, but which are actually very, very interesting culturally.
And Jonathan Hope here, as we wrap up very quickly, does Shakespeare have any chance of improving his C grade?
Whenever I read Shakespeare, I am amazed by how good it is. I mean, every time, it's a terrible thing when you work on Shakespeare's language and you're always looking for examples to put into essays. I start reading his plays to find examples, and, you know, 2 hours later I'm still reading the play and I haven't found an example because I just go reading thinking, oh my God, amazing, look what he's just done. So, you know, when I say that everything we've counted so far, he's come out right in the middle on average, that's not to say that Shakespeare's doing badly, it's to say that we're doing badly because we have not worked out what it is that we should be looking at.
Well, Jonathan, we have to leave it there. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Hope is an English professor at University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. He's author of Shakespeare's Grammar, The Authorship of Shakespeare's Plays, and Shakespeare and Language. This hour was produced by Colleen Leahy. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.